If you have your Bibles with you, would like to follow along, I'd like to go back to the book of Genesis this morning, the book of Genesis and chapter 40. Chapter 40. We've been spending some time the last few weeks looking at the life of Joseph. There have been so many lessons and quite a few that we've left out, I'm sure. Several more that we've probably not gone into as much detail, as much depth as we ought to, but maybe as time goes along, we'll come back to it from time to time and try to go a little deeper. This morning, I'd like to begin in chapter 40. Can't rehearse everything that we've tried to cover the last few weeks, but let's rehearse just a little bit. You remember Joseph. Joseph, when we are introduced to him in chapter 37, was a 17-year-old boy. He was the next to the youngest of 12 sons, the sons of Jacob, the sons of Israel. And Joseph was the favored one. He was the favorite of his father. He was next to the youngest, but he had a special relationship with his father. He spent a lot of time with his father. He was referred to as the son of his old age, the son of his father's old age, and no doubt spent a lot of time with his father. Joseph was a young man, unfortunately, pretty unique, pretty rare, because he had this deep commitment to that which is right. Now, that shouldn't be so rare in the world, but at that age, it seems to be. I know it was a rare thing for certainly from where I was concerned. It was not a common thing, not only around me, but in my own life. But Joseph, I believe, had that commitment and had a great deal of wisdom because he spent so much time with his father. His father depended on Joseph quite a bit, I'm sure. And when we're introduced to Joseph, we find him hated and despised by his older brothers. He is sent out to check on them one day. They were supposed to be out taking care of the flocks, and his father sends him out there to check on them, to see how they were doing, to see how well the flocks were. And full of envy and jealousy and hatred, his brothers see him coming, and they conspire to kill him. Reuben, you remember the oldest of those 12 boys, he persuaded them not to kill Joseph, their younger brother, but instead, let's throw him down into a pit. And that's what they did. Reuben's intentions were to go back and get him later on and deliver him back to his father. Then they conspired together and came up with the idea of selling Joseph. They saw some Ishmaelites coming down the road headed towards Egypt with all their goods and all their wares. And they decided to sell Joseph, make a profit off of him. He wasn't going to be any good to them dead. By the time they get back to the pit, though, they find out that somebody else has come along and gotten Joseph out of that pit. It was a group of Midianites. And those Midianites sold him to the Ishmaelites, who took him down to Egypt and sold him to a man named Potiphar, an officer of the guard, one who worked right up there next to Pharaoh. So Joseph, this 17-year-old boy, goes from being the favorite one in his father's house to being a slave in Egypt, in the house of Potiphar. Now, you remember, if you've been here lately, we've covered a few things that took place along the way. We're repeatedly told that the Lord was with Joseph. Looking at his external circumstances, you might question that. You might wonder, how was it that the Lord was with Joseph? All these bad things are happening to him. You know, he gets down there in Potiphar's house, and because of his commitment to doing that which was right, because of his knowledge and understanding and wisdom at such a young age, because of his just basically his character overall, he did what he was called on to do, and he did it well. He did it to the best of his ability. The Lord prospered everything that he did, and even Potiphar himself was able to see that the Lord was with him. And in fact, so much so that Potiphar put Joseph in charge of everything that he had. Potiphar, the officer of the guard, right up there next to Pharaoh. All of a sudden, now Joseph, he's not so much a slave anymore, but he has the responsibility to take care of everything in Potiphar's house. Potiphar gave him charge of everything except Potiphar's wife, right? Except Potiphar's wife. And then in just a little while, we find Potiphar's wife coming along. Joseph was no doubt, he was a good-looking young man. It says that he was a goodly man and well-favored. That means he was not only a good-looking young guy, but he was a good person. He was committed to right, to righteousness. He was committed to doing that which was right. And may I say something, young ladies? You see a good-looking young man, if his good looks impress you more than his moral character, run the other way. Well, you might be friends with him. You might even try to help him in some way. But before you even think about entering into a relationship that might turn into something very serious, you be sure that his moral character is what it ought to be, but it is also motivated by his commitment to God, not his desire to change just for your sake. Okay? All right. Here's Potiphar's wife. Potiphar's wife looks upon this good-looking young man, as a servant in her household, and she begins to tempt him. She wants to have an affair with him. And he refuses. He explains to her why. I thought that was a pretty noble thing for him to do. Explains to her why. My master, your husband, has put me in charge of everything. He's given me everything in his household except you, because you're his wife. How could I do this evil, not only against him, but against God? How could I sin against God? She is relentless. She just keeps on and on and on, and day after day after day after day. Until one day, he's all alone, and she comes in, and she tries it again, and he flees. We talked about that a little bit a week or two ago. When there's temptations, that it's all you can do to resist, and if you have no other choice, in fact, maybe it's the best choice, the first choice, just get out of Dodge. And that's what he did. He got himself out of there, but he left behind his coat. She falsely accuses him before all the rest of the people there, all the other men in the household. And then we find Joseph cast into prison, falsely accused, something he did not do, something he was not guilty of, but he's in prison. But even in prison, the keeper of the prison recognized something different about this young man, and before you know it, then he's in charge of all the prisoners in the prison, and yes, the Lord was with him. The Lord was with him every step of the way. Now, I don't know how far along we'll get, because that took a few minutes to just kind of rehearse where we've been, leaving out a lot of things. Before we get through with this, and I don't know when that'll be, it might be today, but in case we don't come back to it anytime soon, I want you to think about the ending of this story. I hate to refer to it as a story. It's not fiction. It's real. It really happened. This was a real man, a real place, a real family, a real time, a real event. At the end, Joseph declares, in fact, I'm going to read this from chapter 45, not quite at the end, but let me read this very quickly. Joseph declares some things here in chapter 45, and I think it's important for us to grab a hold of. He makes this one statement. After all of these seemingly bad things that happened to Joseph, there was a purpose in all of this. But don't get me wrong here. Don't get the wrong idea. All of these bad things that happened to Joseph and that continue to take place in his life were not caused by God. God did not cause Joseph's brethren to hate him. And that's kind of where all this started. Joseph's brethren hated him, but God was not the cause of that. But God took that bad situation, intervened in it, and every step of the way, when Joseph wound up in Egypt, God intervened. When Joseph wound up in prison, God intervened. When Joseph, we'll see this morning, was forgotten in prison, God intervened. God didn't cause any of those bad things to happen, but God will continually intervene in our lives to bring about His purpose. He will intervene. He will override, but He doesn't cause evil. He doesn't cause sin, never has, never will. Amen? Thank you. Now, one thing Joseph does say, though, God did send me before you to preserve life. He's talking to his brethren a little bit later on down the road. God sent me before you. God was with Joseph every step of the way, preserving Joseph and intervening in his life so that at the end, this little family of Jacob's would be preserved, they would be saved, and they would begin to multiply, they would begin to grow, and they would begin to turn into a great nation. In fact, the 12 tribes of Israel, as you recall. In fact, as you might well know, in the very last chapter of Genesis, Joseph makes this statement to his brethren after their father dies. He said this, "As for you, ye thought evil against me." He says to his brothers, everything you were doing way back then, you were doing it because of evil, because you hated me, because you were jealous, because you envied me, you despised me. And what you did out of the evil part of your natural man. You did that out of an evil heart with evil intentions, but God meant it unto good. God intervened, God overrode, he put himself into the situation and preserved Joseph so that God's will would be carried out in the end. Now, chapter 40, Joseph is in prison. The keeper of the prison gave him the responsibility of everything that was going on in the prison. As you begin chapter 40, we're introduced to two more men. They're referred to as the butler and the baker. They work for Pharaoh. The butler and the baker who worked for Pharaoh did something that Pharaoh didn't like. Don't know what that was. Don't know if maybe some of the other butlers that worked under them or the bakers that worked under them, maybe they did something and they were responsible, so Pharaoh took it out on them. I don't know. Don't know what happened. But the butler and the baker did something that Pharaoh didn't like, and he casts them into prison, there in the same prison where Joseph was, okay? We're told that the captain of the guard, you know the only person I can come up with? Potiphar. Potiphar was called the captain of the guard back in chapter 39. And here in chapter 40, while Joseph is still in prison, and this butler and baker are thrown into prison, we're told that the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them. The captain of the guard, Potiphar. I wonder what happened along the way that now Potiphar seemingly has a renewed respect for Joseph. I wonder, can't help but wonder, if Potiphar now has discovered that all along that was a lie. That he actually imprisoned Joseph on a false accusation by his own wife, but now he's not going to let that be known. I just wonder. Because Potiphar himself now tells Joseph, Joseph, you're responsible for these two men. And in fact, I want you to serve them. You're going to watch over them. You're going to be with them day in and day out. You're going to serve them. You're going to take care of this situation. These two guys work for Pharaoh, and I don't want anything to happen to them. So Joseph now has a new responsibility. For whatever reason, the butler and the baker are there. There they are. These two guys, the butler and the baker, they both have a dream. They each have their own dreams. And it says in verse 6 that Joseph came in unto them in the morning and looked upon them, and behold, they were sad. And he asked Pharaoh's officers, that is the butler and the baker, that were with him in the ward of his Lord's house, saying, wherefore look ye so sadly today? You know, the more I read about Joseph, just he's a likable young guy. I have not seen any indication yet that Joseph has been complaining, that he's been, although he's had plenty to complain about, he's not been whining, although there's plenty for him to have whined about. He's not even spoken up in defense of himself yet. And we can get into, and maybe we'll in the near future, get into all of those parallels to see how, you know, the life of Jesus Christ as manifest in Joseph. Maybe we'll come back to that before long as well. Joseph has not said a word, as far as we know, all this time. And he comes in and he sees these two guys, the butler and the baker, and he notices that they're sad. Now, I'm just thinking, if I try, I'll try to put myself in this situation. You do too. If I'm in prison, and I'm here on false charges, I'm not guilty, but I'm here. And here's these two characters from Pharaoh's house. They come in, and now I've got to take care of them. I've been given the responsibility. I wouldn't be in a real good frame of mind. And I probably could care less, or couldn't care less, if they were sad or not. But I walk in the morning, and I see this butler and their baker, and they look sad. I don't care. But Joseph did. He was genuinely concerned. Why do you look sad? It was noticeable. And they were sad because they each had a dream. I just really like Joseph. Joseph, in fact, let's think about this for just a minute. Joseph was truly a content young man. You that were here last Sunday, and probably several times over the last few months, you've heard me say more than once that there is a difference between being content and being satisfied. Can we go down that road for just a second? Let's think about that for just a minute. And I think, I get the idea that Joseph is a man, a young man, of contentment. And what do I mean by that? Well, let's go over to the New Testament. Hold your place there in Genesis 40, and we'll be back. But let's go over to the New Testament, Philippians, for just a few minutes. Philippians, let's go to chapter 4. And remember, I'm trying to tag off of this scene here where Joseph comes in as a fellow prisoner, and he's concerned about his co-prisoners while they're sad. You know, there are days, and there are days that you do this too. There are days you go to school, you go to class, you go to work, you go to wherever, and you're oblivious to everybody else around you. You don't know if they're happy, if they're sad. You don't know if they're rejoicing. You don't know if they're weeping. You don't know because you're all caught up in your own little world. Am I being too harsh? I do this all the time. I know you do. We're all pretty much alike. You know, we're not much different in this area. You might even come into the church kind of caught up in your own little world and not notice that somebody over here is sad, somebody over here is rejoicing, and we're told to rejoice with them that rejoice. We're told to weep with them that weep. But see, we get caught up in our own little worlds, and we don't pay attention to those kinds of things. Joseph here in prison, he comes in one morning. Wow, my fellow prisoners are sad. I wonder why. I think I'll ask them. And he did. And the fellow prisoners told Joseph why they were sad, because they've had these dreams. Joseph was a young man who was content. And whatever situation he found himself in, whether it was back there over in his father's house, whether he's, down in that pit, whether he's riding along with the Ishmaelites, being sold, you know, about to go into Egypt as a slave, whether he's in Potiphar's house, everything going well, or when suddenly he finds himself falsely accused and in prison, Joseph continues to be committed to that which is right. He continues to do what he's called on to do and do the very best that he can, and the Lord prospered him in his ways. That is a mark of contentment. Let's make the connection. Philippians chapter 4, beginning in verse 10. Paul writes this, "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at the last your care of me hath flourished again, wherein you were also careful, but you lacked opportunity." Paul says to the Philippians, to the church at Philippi, you've always shown a concern for me, and there was a time that you helped provide my needs the best you could, but there was a period of time where you weren't able to do that. You wanted to, and you were still concerned, but you lacked the opportunity. And now this church at Philippi has been able to renew that care of Paul, and he is thanking them for it. You've always had the concern there. Sometimes the opportunity is there. Sometimes the ability is there. Sometimes not. And Paul thanks them for that. And listen to what he says. "Not that I speak in respect of want." It's not that I'm telling you this. It's not that I'm thanking you for this. It's not that I'm even making any mention of it at all for my own sake. Not as though I stand in want and need. He says, "For I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content." To be content. You know what contentment is? Contentment is an attitude. It is an attitude that is not based upon your external circumstances. And you can make a note of that if you want to. You can write that down. That's a good definition. Contentment is an attitude not based on your external circumstances. Okay? Because in fact, if your attitude about anything is ever based to any degree on your external circumstances, I don't want to be around you much, because you're never going to have a really good attitude if you base everything, you know, every thought and all your feelings and you know, and all of this, you base your outlook on life on your external circumstances, If I do that, I'm not going to be a pleasant person to be around. Contentment is an attitude, and it's not based on your external circumstances. It's different from being satisfied. Satisfaction comes when your needs, your desires, your expectations, when all of that is met. That's satisfaction. Have you achieved that yet? Will you achieve that in this life? When all your desires, all your wants, all your needs, all your expectations, when all of that is met, then you'll be satisfied. And when is that going to be? Not in this world. Amen? Not in this life. So there's a great difference between contentment and satisfaction. I'll never be, I shouldn't be, satisfied with my efforts as a husband because all the needs and expectations and desires and wants are not met. I should never be satisfied with my efforts as your pastor because all the needs and wants and desires and expectations aren't met. I am content in the position I'm in. You might not be, but I am, and I'm content to be my wife's husband. I'm content with the job that I have, that I work the rest of the week to pay the bills. I'm content there, but I'm not satisfied with the job that I do because all of the needs, expectations, wants, and desires are not met. There's a difference. Now, let me share this with you. We don't need to get caught up and think ourselves continually failing every day because we haven't met all of the needs and wants and expectations and desires. Okay, we don't need to get caught up in that because soon we'll be in a state of depression. So there's a balance here. If our satisfaction, our eventual satisfaction, because we will eventually be satisfied, and then the reason we'll eventually be satisfied is because Christ is our satisfaction. And because of what Christ did, you remember God, he looked, he saw of the travail of his soul. In fact, I guess you could say Christ there in Isaiah 53. He saw of the travail of his soul, and he was satisfied. God was satisfied with the sacrifice that Christ made for you, and that's the only reason that any of us will ever be completely satisfied. You know what? God was satisfied with the work of Christ, and we ought to be also. We ought to be satisfied with his work. And we're content in the position that we're in, but that doesn't mean that there's not any room for more, better, improvement. There'll always be room for that. Paul says, I've learned whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. This is something you have to learn. This is something you have to work at, to practice. It doesn't come naturally. What comes naturally to me is to gripe and complain and whine. We have to work at this. Paul learned this, and listen to how Paul learned it. I know both how to be abased, and I know how to abound. I've been there. And whether I've been abased or whether I'm abounding, he says, everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. Paul has seen it all. He's been through trials. I can't even begin to name everything that Paul went through, but you know much of what Paul went through. And in every situation, he says, I have learned to be content. Did Paul sit back and not do anything else? Did Paul sit back, okay, well, that's enough. I've done all I can do. I'm just going to sit back and... No, when you sit back and begin to rest, now there's a time for rest, but when you sit back in the satisfaction of your own efforts, then you're going to become complacent. And then you know what happens when you become complacent? Listen to me. When you become complacent, you begin to get swallowed up by the world. You just think about that. You think about how that digression works. All right, so Joseph, here's a young man who has learned contentment. He's not griping and complaining and whining. He sees his fellow prisoner come in, and he's committed to righteousness. He has knowledge and understanding. He's gained some wisdom along the way, and he has a genuine interest in his fellow man, in this case, his fellow prisoners, but the butler and the baker. There's a lot more I kind of like to... Let's back up a few pages to 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Let's get this... chapter 12. Let's get this on our way back to Genesis. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Some of this is very familiar ground to many of you. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Paul is sharing this same idea here in the previous chapter, and as I've said more than once lately, you remember the chapter and verse divisions weren't, you know, inspired. They weren't there when these letters were originally written, but it helps us to kind of navigate. And so when you back up into chapter 11, Paul has been enumerating all of the things that he has faced. I want you to listen carefully. There's so many lessons here. Paul has no desire to glory in anything of himself. In fact, he refers to himself as a fool if he begins to glory in anything of himself. And he kind of, I won't say plays around with the church at Corinth here. He's a very wise man. And he says, you know, others have come along and you've allowed them, other ministers, and you've allowed them to glory in all of their good things, the good things that they've done, all their good attributes that they possess. You've allowed them to glory. He says to them something like this: allow me that same privilege. Let me glory a little bit. In fact, I'll become a fool in glorying if you'll let me. He said, but here's what I want to glory in. I'll glory in my infirmities. He said, because I know there's nothing of me worthy of any glory, of any honor, of any credit. Nothing. In fact, he begins to enumerate all of these things that he suffered, all of these different perils that he endured. And not only all the things that he suffered and all of the perils that he endured, but also the care, the concern that he had for all of the churches that he had been involved in. He says in verse 30 of chapter 11, if I must needs glory, I will glory of the things which concern mine infirmities. Now, I haven't forgotten about Joseph. But you think about what Joseph has suffered. You think about the things that he has endured. You think about the perils that he has faced at a very young age as well. Paul says here in chapter 12, here's something I would glory in. I knew a man that was caught up into the third heaven. And this man was not able to utter the things that he saw. It was not only was it not lawful, it was not possible. He said, I would glory in that person. I would glory in that. I think he's talking about himself, actually. He said, I would come to revelations and visions. I would, if you'll let me, I would glory in those things. He said, but you know what happened? He said, lest I should be exalted above measure, the Lord gave me a thorn in the flesh. He gave me something to keep me grounded. He gave me something to keep me humbled. Every once in a while, we need something to humble us. Paul sought the Lord for that. He sought him three times, asking him to remove that thorn in the flesh. And this is what I wanted. Verse 9, chapter 12. And he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. I'll glory in my infirmities, because I know that in my infirmities, when I am made weak, when I am humbled, when I am brought low, that is the time that the power of Christ rests upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities. And now, Paul's not talking about some kind of sick, twisted pleasure in these things. His pleasure comes even in the midst of the infirmities and reproaches and necessities and persecutions and distresses for Christ's sake. The pleasure comes, he says, for when I am weak, then am I strong. Paul found pleasure in that. Not in the infirmity itself, not in the peril itself. Joseph wasn't finding a good time in prison. But Joseph was a young man, who was content with the situation of the day. He wasn't satisfied. He wasn't satisfied with his efforts. He wasn't satisfied over the fact, I'm sure, that he had been falsely accused. But he is where he is today, and he's going to find contentment. And his focus was not on himself. It wasn't on his circumstance. It wasn't on those external circumstances. His focus was on the Lord. And since his focus was on the Lord, he could express compassion, care, concern, something for his fellow prisoner. Did we make that circle complete? Joseph was a young man who was content. And he asks the butler and baker back in Genesis 40. He said, "Why are you so sad?" And the butler and baker tell Joseph, "Well, we've had dreams, and we don't know what they mean. And when I read about these dreams, I guess being Egyptians like they were, they probably put a lot of stock in their dreams. And dreams can sometimes mean something. Sometimes dreams are just, Ebenezer Scrooge said, an undigested piece of bacon. You know, sometimes that's what dreams are. And they don't make any sense. And they're crazy. And they're just. But sometimes dreams might mean something. And a lot of you didn't get that reference, did you? You need to watch A Christmas Carol, Ebenezer Scrooge, this coming Christmas. It's a good movie. And you'll understand that reference. So the butler and baker, they begin to tell Joseph their dream. The butler goes first. He says, "In my dream, there was a vine. There was a vine with three branches. And these three branches began to bud. And the blossoms shot forth. And then clusters of grapes came along." That's the butler's dream. Okay, get the picture now. The butler dreamed about a vine with three branches. It budded. It bloomed. Grapes came forth. And then he said, "And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. And I took the grapes. And I pressed them into Pharaoh's cup. And I gave the cup to Pharaoh." That was his dream. Joseph, he had made the statement up there a little bit earlier when they were saddened, when they said, "We're sad because we had a dream, we don't know the interpretation." Joseph made the statement, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me them, I pray you." Joseph had confidence and faith and trust in God, so much so that he says to this butler and this baker, "Interpretations come from God." You know what? Every good gift comes from God. Every gift, every talent that you have, everything of any good whatsoever that you possess is from God. You may have great talents. You may have great abilities. You may have the gift of interpreting dreams. But it came from God. Don't ever forget it. Give Him the honor. Give Him the glory. Give Him the credit for it. You know, I've not seen anything thus far. The only references that we've had so far about dreams concerning Joseph is the dreams that Joseph had. Joseph had a couple of dreams. Remember, they got him in trouble. They just stirred up the wrath and envy of his brothers even more. Joseph had a couple of dreams a few years ago, however long it's been. He had two dreams, and in both of those dreams, the picture that it presented, the interpretation of those dreams, led the rest of the family to believe, and this was true, that they would someday bow down to Joseph. And it incensed his brothers. It angered them. All right? So that's all we know so far about Joseph and dreams. But here, Joseph says, "Interpretations belong to God. Tell me what you've dreamed." And I think he's genuine. He's not out there trying to boast of his gift. He's not trying to impress anybody. I mean, who's he going to impress? He's in prison. But out of genuine concern, in his contented state in prison, he's going to help out his fellow man. All right? So Joseph tells him, "Butler, Mr. Butler, the dream you've had is this. This is what it means. The three branches, they represent 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh," the expression in verse 13 says, "shall lift up thine head." Now, that has reference to the office that the butler held. It didn't really have direct reference to his head. It had a reference to the office that he possessed before he came to prison. And he says, "Pharaoh, in 3 days, he's going to lift you up and he's going to restore you onto your place. You're going to deliver Pharaoh's cup into his hand just like it was before you came down here to prison. You're going to be restored to the position where you were." The baker hears all this and, "Wow, that sounds pretty good. I think I'll tell Joseph my dream." So the baker tells Joseph his dream, and the baker's dream was this: "I had three white baskets on my head, Joseph. I know this is weird. This is a weird dream, but I had three white baskets on my head. And in the uppermost basket," I guess they were like stacked up, you know, "in the uppermost basket, there was all manner of," the word is, "baked meats." Just meats that the baker would have prepared when he was the baker. Food. And so that's what was in these baskets stacked up on top of his head. But he said, the birds came along and they ate that meat out of the baskets that were on my head. What does that mean? That sounds like some weird dream I would have. What does that mean, Joseph? Well, Mr. Baker, those three baskets represent 3 days. And in 3 days, Pharaoh's going to lift up your head. In other words, take the position that you were in. And he says, he's going to take that from you. He's going to take that away from you, and then he's going to hang you. Bad news, Mr. Baker. I'm sorry, but that's the interpretation from the Lord. And the birds shall eat thy flesh from off of thee. Ugh. So Joseph interprets these dreams for the butler and the baker. And lo and behold, for the sake of time, exactly the way Joseph interpreted those two dreams for Mr. Butler and Mr. Baker, that's what happened. In 3 days, well, it was Pharaoh's birthday too. So in 3 days, Pharaoh throws himself a big celebration for his birthday, and he calls those two guys up out of prison, and he restores the butler to where he was, and the butler's up there serving Pharaoh his wine, but the baker is carried out on the edge of town, strung up by the neck, and hanged on a tree, just like Joseph interpreted. Joseph told the butler, Mr. Butler, when you are restored, Joseph had all confidence in what God had revealed to him. While Joseph interpreted the dream that the butler had, he said, and when you get back up there, when you're restored to your former position, would you please remember me? Please remember me. He said, I'm no different from you. I'm in this prison, falsely accused. I don't belong here. It was the only hint, really, that we found of Joseph anywhere near beginning to complain. He said, I'm a Hebrew. I'm in a strange land. I'm in prison. He said, so when you get back up there, would you remember me, please? And you know, most of you, a lot of you perhaps, know what continues, what transpires. You'll move into the next chapter, and you'll find out that the butler forgot Joseph. In fact, the last verse of chapter 40, yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forgat him. There's so much more to this. We have Joseph, this young man, who from all indications, from all external indications, all external circumstances have been against him, time after time after time. But time after time after time, the Lord was with Joseph. I don't know if that made sense a few minutes ago or not, but to me, this is one of the greatest lessons of contentment that I can find in all of Scripture. To be content, no matter what situation you're in, you're committed to doing that which is right, you're committed to doing the very best you can, you're committed to whatever you put your hands to, you do it in the name of Jesus Christ. You do it as unto the Lord. Not as unto men. Joseph's motivation was not Potiphar, was not Pharaoh. Joseph's motivation was not revenge. Joseph's motivation was nothing but a commitment to doing that which is right. That will keep you content no matter what your circumstances are.